A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the Oslo Accords, their history, how they came together, and why an interim framework from 1993 is still running the show in 2026. The core question is, what's still legally operative, and how the Accords architecture shapes everything from where people can build houses to how tax money flows? There's something almost surreal about a 5-year temporary deal being the governing structure for 3 decades, and that paradox is exactly where we need to start.
It's the most consequential temporary arrangement in modern diplomatic history. The Oslo Accords were signed on September 13, 1993, on the White House lawn, that handshake between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat with Clinton standing behind them like a proud referee. The target completion date was May 4, 1999. That was 33 years ago, and the framework is still legally in effect, still determining where roughly 5 million Palestinians can live, travel, build, and work.
A 5-year interim that's now older than most of the people living under it. That's not a diplomatic process. That's a permanent condition with a temporary label.
That's the thing most coverage gets wrong. People call Oslo a failed peace treaty. It wasn't a peace treaty. It was a framework for negotiations, a confidence-building mechanism designed to lead to a final status agreement that never came. It didn't fail so much as it was never completed. The scaffolding became the building.
Scaffolding that now has plumbing, electrical, and a very aggressive homeowners association.
To understand why an interim agreement from 1993 still governs today, we need to look at what Oslo actually was and wasn't. There are really 2 core documents. Oslo I, signed in September 1993, was the Declaration of Principles, a short, relatively vague document that established mutual recognition between Israel and the PLO and laid out a framework for Palestinian self-governance. Oslo II, signed in September 1995, was the real machinery, a 400-page interim agreement that created the Palestinian Authority, divided the West Bank into areas A, B, and C, and established the Palestinian Legislative Council. That's the document still in effect today.
Plus the 1998 Y River Memorandum, which was basically a patch update.
Right, Y River was supposed to implement provisions of Oslo II that had stalled, particularly Israeli redeployment from parts of Hebron and surrounding areas. It was the first of many attempts to get the original timeline back on track, and it mostly didn't work. But the key thing to understand is the territorial division. Area A, about 18% of the West Bank, is under full Palestinian civil and security control. That's the major Palestinian cities, Ramallah, Nablus, Jenin, Bethlehem, most of Hebron. Area B, about 22%, is under Palestinian civil control, but Israeli security control. That's most Palestinian villages and rural areas. Area C, 60% of the West Bank, is under full Israeli military and civil control. That's where the settlements are, where most of the open land is, and where any future Palestinian state would need territorial contiguity.
The PA got control over population centers, but not the land between them. It's like being given the rooms of a house, but not the hallways.
That's exactly the structural problem, and it wasn't an accident. It was the deliberate result of a negotiation where the hardest questions were deferred. Final borders, the status of Jerusalem, Palestinian refugees, Israeli settlements, security arrangements, water rights, all of these were designated as final status issues to be resolved by May 1999. Oslo built an elaborate institutional architecture for the interim period while leaving the permanent structure entirely undefined.
How did we get from a secret back channel in a Norwegian living room to a 400-page agreement that still determines where millions of people can live and travel?
This is where the origin story matters. In early 1993, official Israeli-Palestinian negotiations were happening in Washington, and they were going nowhere. Both sides were stuck on recognition questions. Israel refused to talk directly to the PLO, which it considered a terrorist organization. the Palestinian delegation from the occupied territories had to get approval from PLO leadership in Tunis for every position.
The real decision makers weren't even in the room.
Enter Terje Rud Larsen, a Norwegian sociologist, and his wife Mona Juul, who was a Norwegian foreign ministry official. They saw an opening. Norway wasn't a major power. It had no strategic interests in the Middle East, which made it non-threatening to both sides. Rud Larsen had connections with Israeli academics and Palestinian officials through his research work. In January 1993, they facilitated the first meeting between Yair Hirschfeld, an Israeli history professor, and Ahmed Qeri, known as Abu Allah, a senior PLO official at a farmhouse outside Oslo.
A sociologist, a history professor, and a PLO official walk into a farmhouse. There's a joke in here somewhere.
The setting was deliberately informal. No flags, no name cards, no press. The Norwegians provided the venue and facilitation, but stayed in the background. The critical breakthrough came when the Israeli side, first Hirschfeld, then later Deputy Foreign Minister Yossi Beilin, and eventually Foreign Minister Shimon Peres himself, agreed to deal directly with PLO officials. This was illegal under Israeli law at the time, which prohibited contact with the PLO. Peres kept Prime Minister Rabin informed, but the talks were deniable.
Deniability as a feature, not a bug.
By August 1993, they had hammered out the Declaration of Principles. The PLO recognized Israel's right to exist in peace and security and renounced terrorism. Israel recognized the PLO as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Those letters of mutual recognition, exchanged on September 9 and 10, 3 days before the White House ceremony, were the real substance. Everything else flowed from that.
The handshake was the photo op. The letters were the contract.
The contract had a fundamental asymmetry built in. The PLO recognized Israel as a state with defined borders, the pre-1967 lines, though that wasn't explicit in the letters. Israel recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinian people, not as the government of a Palestinian state. The Palestinians gave up their primary bargaining chip, recognition, up front, in exchange for a promise of a process that might lead to statehood.
Which brings us to the assassination. Rabin in November 1995.
This is the inflection point. Rabin was Oslo's Israeli champion. He had the security credentials, former chief of staff during the Six-Day War, former defense minister to sell territorial compromise to the Israeli public. When Yigal Amir, a right-wing Israeli extremist, shot him at a peace rally in Tel Aviv on November 4, 1995, Oslo lost its political engine. Shimon Peres took over as prime minister but lost the 1996 election to Benjamin Netanyahu, who had campaigned explicitly against the accords.
Netanyahu ran on, "If they give, they'll get. If they don't give, they won't get." A complete inversion of the land for peace logic.
Yet Netanyahu didn't scrap Oslo. He renegotiated parts of it, the Hebron Protocol in 1997, the Y River Memorandum in 1998, but he kept the framework. This is a pattern that repeats. Israeli governments run against Oslo, then govern within it. The institutions were too embedded to dismantle without replacing them with something else, and nobody had a replacement.
The Hebron Protocol is worth a moment. It took 18 months of negotiations to implement Oslo II's provisions for a single city.
The result was a microcosm of the entire problem. Hebron was divided into H1, about 80% of the city under full Palestinian control, and H2, the remaining 20% under Israeli control, where roughly 800 Jewish settlers lived in the heart of a Palestinian city of over 200,000 people. The protocol required joint patrols, separate checkpoints, and elaborate security arrangements that turned a city into a legal patchwork. If it took 18 months to negotiate arrangements for one city, the idea that final status could be resolved by 1999 was always a fantasy.
The 5-year timeline wasn't ambitious. It was delusional.
Both sides agreed to the timeline knowing it was unrealistic because the alternative was no agreement at all. The Oslo architects, particularly the Israeli architects, believed that the interim period would build trust, create economic interdependence, and make final status concessions politically possible. The Palestinian leadership believed that the interim institutions would evolve into state institutions, creating facts on the ground that would make Palestinian statehood inevitable.
Both were wrong.
The Camp David summit in July 2000 was the moment of reckoning. Ehud Barak, who had defeated Netanyahu in 1999, pushed for a final status agreement. Bill Clinton convened Barak and Arafat at Camp David for 2 weeks of intensive negotiations. Barak offered a Palestinian state in roughly 91% of the West Bank plus a land swap, Palestinian sovereignty over parts of East Jerusalem, and a limited right of return for refugees. Arafat rejected it.
The debate about who was responsible for Camp David's failure has its own academic sub-industry. But the structural point is that the gap between what either side could accept and what the other could offer was still enormous. On Jerusalem, on refugees, on borders.
The Second Intifada erupted in September 2000 after Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount. Within months, the Oslo framework was politically dead. The PA lost control of Area A, cities, to Israeli military reoccupation during Operation Defensive Shield in 2002. The Palestinian Legislative Council building in Ramallah was shelled. Security coordination collapsed. Arafat was confined to his compound until his death in 2004.
That's where the story usually ends. But this is where our story actually gets interesting, because the machinery Oslo built didn't disappear. It just kept running without a driver.
That collapse in 2000 is often where the story ends. But the machinery Oslo built didn't disappear. It just kept running without a driver. The Palestinian Authority continued to exist. Areas A, B, and C remained legally in effect. The Paris Protocol kept governing economic relations. Security coordination resumed after Arafat's death under Mahmoud Abbas. The institutional framework survived the political process it was designed to serve.
Which brings us to Area C, Oslo's most enduring physical legacy. 60% of the West Bank remains under full Israeli military and civil control. As of 2026, roughly 400,000 Israeli settlers live there, alongside about 300,000 Palestinians who are subject to Israeli military law, not Palestinian civil law.
The settler population numbers tell their own story. In 1993, there were approximately 250,000 settlers in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. By 2026, that number exceeds 700,000. The Oslo period, supposedly a peace process leading to Palestinian statehood, saw the settler population nearly triple.
Peace process as camouflage for territorial entrenchment. I've said this before. The negotiations provided political cover, while the settlement enterprise expanded under every Israeli government, Labor and Likud alike.
The Oslo A Second Map created a patchwork that makes contiguous Palestinian territory almost impossible without removing settlements or building elaborate bypass infrastructure. Area C isn't a single block. It's interwoven with areas A and B in a way that fragments Palestinian territory into dozens of disconnected enclaves. A Palestinian driving from Ramallah to Nablus passes through multiple checkpoints and crosses between areas of different legal jurisdiction. The permit regime for movement between areas is one of the most concrete ways Oslo still operates daily.
Let's talk about the Palestinian Authority's structural crisis, because this is where Oslo's design flaws become inescapable. The PA was created as a self-governing body with no sovereignty. It doesn't control borders. It doesn't control airspace. It doesn't control natural resources, water, minerals, electromagnetic spectrum. It doesn't have a currency. It doesn't control international trade. It's a municipality with a foreign ministry.
That foreign ministry can issue statements but can't sign treaties. The PA's security mandate is to coordinate with Israel, the famous security coordination that many Palestinians view as collaboration. Oslo II explicitly obligates the PA to prevent terrorism and arrest militants. The PA's security forces essentially serve as Israel's first line of defense in areas A and B, which creates a profound legitimacy problem.
You're a Palestinian police officer in Nablus. Your job, defined by Oslo, is to prevent attacks on Israelis. But the Israeli military still raids your city whenever it wants. Your own population sees you as a subcontractor for the occupation. That's not a recipe for institutional legitimacy.
The economic dimension compounds this. The Paris Protocol, signed in 1994 as part of the Oslo framework, established a customs union between Israel and the Palestinian territories. Israel collects import duties and VAT on goods destined for Palestinian markets and transfers the revenue to the PA. This amounts to roughly $2 billion annually, about 60 to 70% of PA revenues. Since 1994, Israel has withheld these tax transfers 47 times as a political measure.
A self-governing authority that doesn't control its own revenue is a tenant, not a government.
Most recently, in March 2026, Israel withheld PA funds over the continued PA policy of paying stipends to families of Palestinians killed or imprisoned in connection with attacks on Israelis, what Israel calls the pay for slay policy, and Palestinians call support for prisoners and martyrs' families. The PA's entire fiscal structure depends on Israeli cooperation, which gives Israel a permanent leverage point.
The PA has incentives to maintain the framework, because its funding and institutional existence depend on it. Israel benefits from the territorial division and security coordination without having to govern 35 million Palestinians directly. And the international community has no consensus on a replacement. That's a self-reinforcing status quo.
This is why no alternative framework has replaced Oslo, despite universal acknowledgement of its failure. Every actor has a veto on change, but no actor can impose an alternative. The Palestinian Authority can't walk away from Oslo without dissolving itself and losing its funding. Israel doesn't want to dismantle the PA, because that would mean assuming direct responsibility for governing areas A and B, which would be an administrative and military nightmare. The international community, the UN, the EU, the Arab League, can't agree on what would replace Oslo.
The 2024 UN Security Council resolution, calling for a two-state solution with a concrete timeline, was vetoed by the United States. The international community is still operating within Oslo's paradigm, even while acknowledging it's broken.
This is where the legal dimension gets fascinating. The International Criminal Court ruled in 2021 that it has jurisdiction over the West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem. Israel argued that Oslo supersedes Geneva Convention obligations, that because the territories are disputed under an interim framework rather than occupied, the Fourth Geneva Convention doesn't fully apply. The ICC, the International Court of Justice, and the UN Security Council have all rejected this interpretation, but Israel maintains it, and the Oslo framework provides the legal architecture for the argument.
It's not occupied. It's disputed. The entire legal defense rests on Oslo's interim status. The temporary framework becomes permanent precisely because calling it permanent would trigger legal obligations nobody wants to face.
Let me give you three concrete ways Oslo still operates in 2026. First, the permit regime. A Palestinian in Area A who wants to travel to Area C, or to East Jerusalem, or to Israel, needs a permit from the Israeli Civil Administration. The permit categories, work permits, medical permits, merchant permits, family visit permits, are all Oslo-era creations. The civil administration processes roughly 200,000 permit applications annually. Second, the Joint Economic Committee, established under the Paris Protocol, still meets to set VAT rates, approve customs procedures, and manage economic disputes between Israel and the PA. It's a bilateral committee that assumes two equal parties, but one party controls the other's revenue. Third, the Civil Administration's Planning and Zoning Committee processes building permits in Area C. The approval rate for Palestinian building permits in Area C is less than 2%. Meanwhile, settlement construction continues under a separate planning track.
Three systems, all running on autopilot, all determining daily life for millions of people. The permit regime alone is a full employment program for bureaucracy.
The February 2026 announcement of Palestinian municipal elections in areas A and B shows how Oslo's mechanisms still constrain even routine governance. The PA announced elections for municipal councils across the West Bank. Israel immediately threatened to block voting in Area B, where it has security control, using Oslo II's security coordination provisions. The legal basis for blocking elections in Palestinian villages is a 33-year-old interim agreement that was supposed to expire in 1999.
The PA hasn't held legislative elections since 2006. Presidential elections have been repeatedly postponed. Abbas is now in the 19th year of a 4-year term. Oslo created democratic institutions that can't function democratically because the territory they govern isn't sovereign.
We haven't even touched on Gaza. The Oslo framework was designed for the West Bank and Gaza as a single territorial unit. A single territorial unit is the exact phrase in Oslo II. The 2007 Hamas takeover of Gaza split that unit in two. The PA governs parts of the West Bank under Oslo rules, while Hamas governs Gaza under a completely separate reality. Blockade, periodic military escalation, reconstruction cycles. The institutional framework never contemplated this division.
Oslo assumed a unified Palestinian polity negotiating toward a single state. Instead, we got a bifurcated polity where the PA's legitimacy in Gaza is essentially zero, and Hamas operates outside the Oslo framework entirely.
Let me address a few misconceptions directly. The first is that Oslo was a peace treaty that failed. It wasn't a peace treaty, it was an interim framework for negotiations. It didn't fail to deliver peace, it succeeded in creating institutions, and then the final status negotiations, those institutions were designed to enable, never reached agreement. The second misconception is that Oslo created the Palestinian Authority as a proto-state. The PA was deliberately designed as a temporary self-governing authority with no sovereignty, no territorial contiguity, and no control over borders, airspace, or natural resources. It was never intended to be permanent. The third misconception is that the Oslo process ended with the Second Intifada. The political process ended, but the institutional framework, the PA, Areas A, B, and C security coordination, the Paris Protocol, remains legally in effect and continues to structure daily life for millions.
The third one is the most important for understanding 2026. Oslo is dead politically, but alive institutionally. Every checkpoint, every permit, every tax shekel that flows through Israeli hands to the PA, that's Oslo still breathing.
If Oslo's institutions are still running the show in 2026, what does that actually mean for anyone trying to understand the conflict today? It means that when you hear two-state solution, you're not hearing a political slogan, you're hearing a reference to a specific failed legal framework. A future agreement wouldn't build on Oslo. It would have to dismantle Oslo's institutions and replace them with something fundamentally different.
The two-state solution isn't a destination. It's a demolition project.
That's what the 2026 UN Special Coordinator's Report essentially acknowledged when it called for a new political horizon without offering any specifics. The report's language was notable. It didn't call for implementing Oslo or returning to negotiations within Oslo's framework. It called for something new, but nobody knows what that something is.
Because any replacement framework would have to answer the questions Oslo deferred. Those questions haven't gotten easier in 33 years. They've gotten harder.
The settler population was 250,000 in 1993. It's over 700,000 now. Any two-state solution would require either incorporating most settlements into Israel through land swaps, which gets harder as settlements expand, or evacuating settlers, which is politically impossible in Israel after the 2005 Gaza disengagement was followed by Hamas rocket fire. The facts on the ground have moved in one direction for three decades.
On the Palestinian side, the PA's legitimacy crisis deepens every year without elections. The generation that remembers the Oslo handshake is aging. The generation coming of age now has only known the PA as an unelected, security-coordinating, fiscally-dependent administration that can't stop settlement expansion or deliver statehood. That's a legitimacy time bomb.
Which brings us to the structural paradox at the heart of all this. The Oslo Accords created a self-reinforcing status quo that nobody is happy with, but nobody can escape. The PA derives its legitimacy and funding from Oslo. It can't dismantle the framework without dismantling itself. Israel benefits from the territorial division and security coordination. It has no incentive to replace a system that gives it control over 60% of the West Bank without the burden of governing Palestinians directly. And the international community funds the PA's budget deficit. Roughly 30% of PA expenditures come from international donors, which keeps the system running without resolving its contradictions.
It's a machine designed to be temporary that's been running for 33 years, and everyone involved has a reason to keep it running, even though they all agree it's going nowhere. The musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. If beige wallpaper could determine citizenship rights and water access.
Let me give you one more concrete example that illustrates the absurdity. The Joint Water Committee, established under Oslo II, requires Israeli approval for any Palestinian water infrastructure project in the West Bank, including in areas A and B, where the PA supposedly has civil control. The committee hasn't met regularly in years. Palestinian water extraction from the mountain aquifer is frozen at 1967 levels, while Israeli settlements in Area C draw freely. The population in the West Bank has more than doubled since Oslo was signed, but the water allocation hasn't changed.
You have a water governance system designed for a 5-year interim period that's been allocating water for 33 years, based on pre-1967 consumption patterns. That's not governance. That's institutionalized neglect.
It's all legally grounded in Oslo II Article 40, which was supposed to be renegotiated in final status talks. The final status talks never happened, but Article 40 is still the law.
What do we take from all this? First, Oslo's architecture isn't neutral. It creates winners and losers, and the winners have veto power over changing it. Second, any future agreement will require dismantling institutions that have been entrenched for over 3 decades. That's harder than building new ones. Third, the interim label was always a political fiction that allowed both sides to sign without confronting the hardest questions. The fiction has now lasted longer than most actual peace treaties.
For listeners following the conflict, understanding Oslo's architecture explains why proposals for a two-state solution keep running into the same wall. It's not that the two sides can't agree on borders, it's that the entire institutional framework of the conflict is built on an interim agreement that was designed to be temporary and became permanent by default. You can't just draw a line on a map. You have to replace the permit regime, the tax collection system, the security coordination apparatus, the water allocation mechanism, the planning and zoning system, and the legal framework for citizenship and residency.
It's not a negotiation. It's a system migration.
System migrations are hard enough when both sides want to migrate. Here, one side has no incentive to change the operating system, and the other side lacks the power to force a change.
The open question for anyone watching this in 2026, can the Oslo framework be reformed, or does it need to be entirely replaced? The UN Special Coordinator's report called for a new political horizon, but offered no specifics. As the PA's legitimacy erodes and settlement expansion continues, the Oslo architecture may eventually collapse under its own weight, but no alternative framework exists. That's not a peace process. That's a governance vacuum waiting to happen.
Next week, we're going to look at how the Gaza blockade, a policy that emerged directly from Oslo's collapse and the Hamas takeover, has created a completely separate legal and economic reality from the West Bank. The Oslo framework assumed a single Palestinian territory. What exists in 2026 is two distinct systems, both dysfunctional in different ways, both traceable to decisions made and deferred in a Norwegian farmhouse 33 years ago.
The scaffolding became the building, and the building is now a maze with no exit. That's Oslo in 2026. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1860s, Japanese merchants used a variant of the abacus called the soroban with a radically different bead configuration. 1 bead above the bar and 4 below, compared to the Chinese swan pans 2 above and 5 below. And by 1868, an estimated 120,000 soroban were in active commercial use across Edo period Japan, making it one of the most densely adopted calculation tools per capita in the pre-industrial world.
120,000 abacuses. 120,000. That's a lot of beads.
The Edo period really had its calculation infrastructure figured out. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to dig deeper into any of the legal frameworks we discussed, the full episode notes are at My Weird Prompts. And if you enjoyed the episode, leaving a review wherever you listen helps more people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time.
time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.